Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, Editor-in-Chief of the Journal, coming to you today with another special edition of the podcast. As many of you will know, we produce what we call the State of the Science issue every January. This year's is a special themed issue on solutionism, the notion that we can get ourselves in trouble by perceiving there to be straightforward solutions, or some would argue the notion that there could be any solution to highly complex problems. So we've commissioned a series of really excellent pieces looking at this topic from a variety of perspectives, and I have the great pleasure today of speaking with one of those authors, Will Bynum, who's Associate Professor of Family Medicine and the Residency Program Director at Duke University School of Medicine. And he and his colleagues have a paper coming out in January 2021 entitled Why Impaired Wellness May Be Inevitable in Medicine, and Why That May Not Be a Bad Thing. Will, welcome, and thank you very much for taking the time to do this.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. This is a great opportunity, and I really appreciate the invitation. And also just want to acknowledge up front my co-authors, Lara Varpio and Pim Tunison, who were just incredibly instrumental in laying out this paper.
Wonderful. It's a great team, so I'm glad you took the moment to do that. This is a time when wellness issues are particularly prominent. It's been a popular issue for many years now, but with COVID and everything else going on in the world, this is particularly timely. What was it for you that led you to believe that this particular perspective that you outline in this paper was necessary at this point in time?
Well, I've been involved in thinking about, writing about, or researching wellness and medicine now for, 8 or 9 years. And it started back during my time in the resident representative arm of the AAMC. And so I've had the privilege, really, of getting to be involved in and observant of the evolution of how we think about, understand, and address impaired wellness in medical trainees and physicians. And so this was a really nice opportunity to reflect on some of those observations, as well as some of what we're learning at a deeper level about how wellness can be experienced or impaired in medical trainees through our research on shame.
And how would you describe what the field's reaction has typically been to the data that suggests concerns about burnout, depression, and other related issues?
Well, it's been significant. It's been rightly termed a public health crisis. I was in the AAMC around the time that there were a few learner suicides up in New York, and where the data on the AAMC graduating questionnaire was analyzed and questions were asked in a different way that revealed a lot more learner mistreatment, I think, than we had realized. And so I've been involved in and observed an upswell, really, of reaction to what has been a very sobering and difficult body of work and literature and data that tells us we have a real problem in the wellness of medical trainees and physicians and other healthcare professionals.
And given the severity and importance of those issues, it's not surprising that people are rushing to try to fix it, to find solutions. And I wonder if you could outline a little bit what has been the norm in your observations in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think, a natural tendency to identify real suffering, especially widespread suffering, and to have data presented to you that tells you how that suffering is occurring and what it's causing. And I really think that, suicidality is the one that probably has the strongest gut punch when we think about the experience of being unwell in medicine. That's the one that really, I think, hits us the hardest. But there are a lot of antecedents to that. And the data is rather overwhelming about the scope of the challenge. And so it's natural, I think, to want to begin fixing that right away because there's actual suffering going on. And I think the tendency has been to develop solutions and to test those solutions and to try to prove their efficacy before we have fully conceptualized or more thoroughly conceptualized the nature of impaired wellness in medical trainees and in physicians. And so we argue in our paper that wellness is a construct, is incredibly complex. It exists on multiple dimensions with multiple inputs. It's highly individualized and contextually influenced in nature. And we really need to be attending to that complexity when we try to support it or optimize it. And I think we have been understandably a bit myopic And the way that we've understood wellness and impaired wellness and the solutions have tended to follow those more narrow perspectives.
So when you describe what we know about the complexity of the issue, that at least implies that we understand quite a bit. What is it that you and your co-authors think to be missing in terms of how we might better move forward rather than jump into the solutions that you raise concerns about?
Yeah, well, I want to clarify up front, I think that I certainly am not criticizing the solutions, nor the work that's been done already. It's more reflecting on them. There are solutions that are working. They tend to be directed towards things that we can measure and identify more easily, such as, you know, burnout, depression, anxiety. And many have been successful, although the net sum of a lot of our efforts has been relatively marginal in terms of its ability to curb rates of burnout, especially as looked at in meta-analyses, et cetera. I think what we have observed and believe is that we have built the body of literature that is being used to characterize impaired wellness in medicine using a set of specific tools. And those tools have been informed by a predominant epistemology or way of viewing the nature of impaired wellness. And those tools are predominantly objective, you know, instruments and measures that seek to measure specific dimensions that may, and increasingly we realize, do negatively impact wellness, such as burnout, depression, anxiety, impaired empathy, et cetera. And each of those scales, you know, being within the objectivist realm, are reflective of at least some degree of a positivist or post-positivist approach to wellness, in that there's a belief that there are specific ways in which wellness can be impaired and that we can isolate them, measure them, address them, and then improve them. And while that is probably true for some dimensions of wellness, it certainly doesn't capture the totality of the experience, the totality of the construct. And so we believe that we might be missing very important aspects of this experience of being well or being unwell because we're not using research methodologies that allow us to identify, characterize, and understand them.
So is that what leads you to labeling impaired wellness as inevitable? What led you to that perspective that this will impact upon all of us?
Well, you know, it's interesting, the paper, this was a very hard paper to write because it was very hard to build these arguments. And somewhat organically, the arguments built upon themselves and actually led us to that conclusion or that theory that if we come to approach impaired wellness through the lens of specific states of impairment that can be diagnosed, i.e. through a Maslach burnout inventory, through a PHQ-9 depression scale, and then therefore treated with the medicine, we propagate the notion that A, they should be treated, B, they can be treated, C, that each individual will respond to the treatment in a similar way, and D, that it will lead to positive outcomes. And I think that there's a risk in approaching something as complex and individualized as wellness in such an objective manner. And there's also a risk in assuming that states of impaired wellness need to be fixed each time or need to be eliminated or avoided. And the challenge with that is that if we adopt that way of thinking, then we are ignoring or undervaluing the potential growth and resilience that can be developed through engaging with those experiences. So, for example, I've been burned out numerous times before. I mean, I would absolutely score off the chart on the Maslach burnout inventory. Those times I haven't always felt globally unwell. You know, I've had a lot of other things going on in my life and other dimensions of my wellness very much intact, but I'm dealing with the issue of burnout specifically. And each time I've dealt with it, I've gotten better at identifying it, kicking in some coping mechanisms and recovering from it. Same with shame. My first shame experience was brutal. It was so jarring and awful and disorienting, but in suffering through it and eventually growing through it, I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about emotion, and I learned a lot about what I have to do if it happens in the future. And so if we removed those triggers or those experiences, which, and I'll talk about this in a minute, I believe is impossible, but if we did try to remove them, then we are potentially also removing the opportunity for resilience development and growth. Now, I'm not saying that we recklessly allow them to occur and we facilitate or enable them, because we do know there's a lot of significant negative outcomes that occur with them. But I don't think we can eliminate them. And the reason that we don't think we can eliminate them is that the nature of medicine and of medical training is such that we believe some form of impaired wellness is inevitable. And we've listed some examples in the paper that help support that argument. But rather than saying we all should be well all the time or most of the time in medicine, it may be more useful to say medicine carries with it an inherent risk of impaired wellness. And we need to learn how to engage with that risk, minimizing it where possible, but even accepting it and then engaging with that which remains.
And so I recognize that these are evolving ideas. And as you said, it was tough to even put this together and was cohesive as it came across and with the exceptional lessons that you've learned as a result of it. But even in these early days of trying to promote this alternative view, what would you advise others in terms of how they support those who are struggling with wellness issues without making it appear or without actually, you know, explicitly trying to just fix the problem?
Yeah, I think the first actually happens outside of the dyad of one person counseling another, and it gets more to the culture, which is that we need to stop seeing impaired wellness as a bad thing, as a weak thing, as something to be avoided. I don't think everyone does that, but I think there's a general mantra, and it may even be a perception among many people, that we shouldn't feel this way, that it's undesirable, that when we feel shame or when we feel depressed, when we're burned out, that we're doing something wrong or that something is wrong. And I think that's a really risky and dangerous paradigm because those experiences, again, we think are much more likely given the demanding nature of the work we do in our environments, but they're also very human and normal reactions to a situation like that. And so the first is we've got to humanize to a reasonable degree, and maybe there's room for debate on this, normalize the experience of impaired wellness in our field. And once we do that, we can then open the door to more vulnerable and open ways of engaging with it and remove some of the stigma that comes with impaired wellness or mental health challenges. So that, I think, is necessary first, or alongside efforts to one-on-one counsel people. And I counsel a lot of learners who are, and even colleagues who are going through shame reactions. And that's not an easy thing to talk with people about. It's a very deeply held emotion. It's painful. It's isolating. And the best way that I find to open the door for those conversations is first to just name it, to normalize it as an understandable reaction, a very human reaction, and then to begin unpacking it and trying to find ways that, you know, we can fix it, but also recognizing that there may be some things we can't fix. You know, I can't fix the fact that some of our trainees will continue to get negative feedback or will fail or will hurt patients at times. So it's not just about helping them get rid of the burnout or get rid of the shame. That's useful and is an important component, but it's also about how to meaningfully engage with it so that rather than letting it overwhelm the system, you can process it in a way that, you know, allows for growth, maintains, you know, a strong sense of self and prepares you to engage with it if it occurs in the future. And so inherent in that, I think, approach is that we believe that these experiences are not things to be eliminated from within ourselves, but rather incorporated and integrated into who we are and accepted, but then overcome, you know, in a resilient manner.
It's a powerful argument and just makes me wonder about where you see this work heading. If I can, you know, just maybe ask you to wrap up by giving us some sense of what you see to be the highest priorities in terms of what we need to be doing some formal research on.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to continue understanding the things that we've put on the radar. So burnout, depression, anxiety, so on and so forth. I mean, those things are really important and they are real. And we do need to continue understanding them, but we've got to broaden the scope. We can't let burnout and depression be the markers of wellness. So we need more research and we need different methodologies. I do qualitative research, so I'm inherently value it. But I think that the qualitative research allows us to identify factors, to characterize constructs, to ask questions, and to understand meaning and the nature of a construct in a much different way than quantitative approaches do. And so I think we need a more balanced set of research methodologies that move away from objectivity as sort of the standard for science in this area and accept the messiness and the complexity of these constructs and maybe apply methodologies that are more apt to help us better understand the depth of that complexity, such as is the case with the more constructivist perspective. So A, I think expanding the methodologies. B, I think it's okay for us to continue testing solutions, but we can't just move into a solutions-oriented posture without expanding the scope of what it means to be well. Because if we do, we're only providing solutions to a very narrow aspect of the issue or the challenge. And so we might need to actually hit pause on some of the solutions, or at least when we're implementing our solutions, ask ourselves, A, is this likely to work? B, is it really needed? Is this what's needed right now? Just because it worked in a randomized control trial doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work in my environment or it's what my people need. And so taking a bit more of a nuanced, local, individualized approach to the application of solutions is necessary. It will be harder to publish the type of science we like to publish on these things if we do that. But I think we need to begin valuing non-objective science, non-quantitative science in this space, and promoting it. And I will say that your journal has done a fantastic job of doing that. And I think many others are really following suit.
There are so many implications from this work, you know, not just for individuals, but for programs and for the culture of professions, as you said, and obviously for the research efforts that we engage in. So not having enough time to go into all those details, I am going to have to direct listeners to the paper itself for an elaboration of the argument that you've just made. I'll remind them that it's entitled Why Impaired Wellness May Be Inevitable in Medicine and Why That May Not Be a Bad Thing. And you'll find it in January 2021 with Will Bynum as the first author. And as I wrap up, I just want to thank you, Will, not just for the excellent paper and the contribution it'll make to our field, but for turning the lens on this issue and what sounds like it'll be a very positive and productive direction, and also for your candor and the way that it alone is going to start helping to normalize these issues for those working in our profession. So I sincerely wish you the best of luck as you continue to develop these ideas.
Thanks, Kevin. And you know, thank you again to the journal for the platform to share. We certainly don't propose any of these arguments as inherently right, but rather just ways to maybe reconceptualize some of the challenges we're facing. And I would welcome any responses or debate in any way. So thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this.
And that nicely ties us back to the whole concept of solutionism, because the point isn't to necessarily give the right or the final solution. So again, for those listening, if you want to read more on that topic from a variety of different perspectives, that's the entire theme that the January 2021 issue has been built around. So until next time, thanks for listening.